it is this fine line between a somewhat critical, somewhat skeptical analysis of the world that around us and this slippery road into the rabbit hole that we need to be mindful all the time.
Hello and welcome to Mixed Feelings, a podcast by the Collaborative Research Center Effective Societies at Freie Universität Berlin. My name is Paulina Aronson. I am a sociologist, a journalist, and I take care of media and public outreach here at the center. And today we're talking about conspiracy theories and more specifically about their emotional pull, why they feel so convincing and what they do to people, relationships and societies. I am very happy to be joined by three wonderful guests with very different perspectives on this topic. Philipp Wunderlich is a researcher at International Psychoanalysis University Berlin, working on the role of emotions in politics, including conspiracy theories, protest, and polarization. He's also connected to our research here at Effective Societies and brings a really important sociological perspective to this conversation. Hi, Philipp.
Hi.
Ilya Yablokov is a lecturer in digital journalism and disinformation at the University of Sheffield. He researches conspiracy theories, misinformation, and political communication with a particular focus on Russia and how these narratives travel across borders. Hi, Ilya.
Hi, Paulina. Hi, guys.
And Florian Jäger is a psychologist working with a Berlin-based organization, Veritas, where he provides counseling for people affected by conspiracy narratives, either directly or through their close relationships. So he brings a very grounded real-life perspective on how these beliefs are experienced emotionally. Hi, Florian.
Hi, happy to be here.
Thank you all so much for being here, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So the other day, I found myself in a yoga studio where I've never been before, and at the reception, there was a stack of magazines called Nexus, and I got particularly puzzled by the cover topic, by the cover article that caught my attention, was called Anti-Gravity, Grave Secrets, How the Deep State Stole Our Future. So the idea that the Earth is flat is already feeling almost outdated, and this goes one step further. Here, gravity itself is framed as a dark conspiracy. And, you know, at first glance, it might feel a little bit absurd, but yet these kind of narratives, they still keep their appeal, and they still find an audience. And so the question for me, the question for us as researchers of emotions and affect is not just about why people believe these things and what they believe, but rather what kind of emotional states these narratives bring in them. What does it mean for them to be emotionally involved? And so my first question goes to you, Florian. In your work with people who come to Veritas for consultations, what kind of emotional states do you experience? What does it feel for people to be, you know, in the midst of these narratives?
Yeah, thank you, Paulina. And although you said like we want to focus on the effective parts, the emotions, I think it's important to also consider why and how people get to this point, because it's interconnected for me. And that is, as we probably know, it's like connected to experiences of powerlessness, of lack of control, lack of autonomy. All these things that cause negative emotions to start with. And actually, conspiracy theories or believing in conspiracy theories can be an emotional answer to that. So they can provide positive emotions and a positive identity. And so as a first step, they can give like a kind of a inner rest and a balance, like even like a feeling of order and security. So they have this kind of helpful side for people who are affected, or they can have this side. When they find their way to us, and you can imagine it's a long way that people come to us and actually seek help, seek support, want to talk about their beliefs, then they're at a different state. I would say we observe, and now the why is again quite important, because why do they come to us? And that's because there are conflicts, not always regarding their worldview. You talked about one conspiracy theory so far, but also about what is causing that in their personal lives, conflicts in families and with jobs and so on. And so when they come to us, they are often nervous in a way, because they know something is about to happen, but they have no idea what is happening. And I mean, they're about to maybe give away a part of their identity. So they have already a bit of doubts before, also making them nervous. They have a bit of ambivalence and feeling of conflict. And they have, at the same time, still a high missionary pressure that's also there. So there's this kind of a tension.
Ilya, is there anything particular about narratives that Russian propaganda spreads? Is there anything particular in Russian-made conspiracy theories that actually builds upon these fears and all these feelings that Florian has been talking about? Is there anything that makes them compelling to the audience outside of Russia?
I think we, when it comes to conspiracy theories that, let's say, endorsed by Russian propaganda, we need to keep in mind that the people that distribute these theories, they are not creating them. They are very good, well, somewhat good at finding them and just spreading them wherever they can, right? Because there is no, I'm quite pessimistic about the efficiency that these guys have. And what they're good at is finding the cracks, finding the issues in communities beyond the Russian borders, and using these cracks, using these issues to shake internally the countries, the governments, etc. So basically, whatever the grief, whatever the problems that people share in Germany, in Belgium, in the UK, no matter where, and as long as these problems are present online, which they normally are, it makes these narratives visible for weaponization, for amplification, for further distribution, and for the further build-up on these narratives in future campaigns. People everywhere more or less suffer from the same issues, right? It's economy, it's political instability, it's the issues of identity and various shifts in identity and the culture wars that are being pushed from both sides of the Atlantic Ocean in that sense. And quite a lot of people react to that, and they pick up these narratives and sort of try to find their kind of shape their worldview towards these narratives. And but again, if you look at what kind of issues that are being documented in the European Union, the issues that are being weaponized by Russian disinformation specialists, there would be Ukraine and financial help to Ukraine, and it would be immigration. And then when it comes to local issues, there would probably be something related to elections or some corruption scandals in the government. So anything that could have been weaponized by domestic actors, domestic forces, or even individuals that are simply not happy about what they experience in their day-to-day life.
Philip, you are researching the societal impacts of conspiracy theories, the way they mobilize people to protest, the way they mobilize people to join various communities, organize in groups. Why is it so easy to weaponize those feelings that Ilya is talking about. What is actually happening to us here in the so-called West? Ilya was just talking about the cracks, you know, that Russian propaganda is using to seep its influence into. What are these cracks? Where are they coming from?
I think that actually we can kind of maybe combine both points that were made before, because Florian talked about this lack of control, the kind of individual reasons why people adhere to conspiracy theories or engage in conspiracy theorizing. And this is kind of the classical psychological perspective on it. So people lack control, people have anxieties, and then conspiracy theories are a way to kind of contain these negative emotions. And then what Ilya talked about is more like this strategic kind of top-down way in which conspiracy actors or entrepreneurs kind of use or look for different political issues or grievances that can be mobilized in that sense. And I think a full understanding of like why people or what drives people in a social setting to these theories kind of incorporates both, right? You have not only personal causes of anxieties or lack of control, but you also have these kind of political and structural causes that you could look at, and these can then be exploited. So it's kind of a complex interplay between this kind of individual level psychology that plays out and then the larger political context in which people, as Ilya said, try to find the cracks in the polity or in the political system or in the social circumstances that can be exploited. And I might add to this that of course we can also look at conspiracy theories from a very different perspective as just a critical stance, as kind of an anti-elite cultural practice, kind of counter-cultural practice that allows people also to question the political system or the political order if they don't find any other ways to do so, I would say.
I would agree with the first part and the second part only partly. I guess, I mean, yeah, as you said, Philip, it's on different levels we looked at that. I would also say that, like, not every person who is influenced by conspiracy theories is also, like, being indoctrinated in a way. But, of course, the theories are out there. They are shared, and they have been out there for many, many years, centuries, partly already. This is what influences it. And we don't, like, with the clients that come to us, we don't observe so often, like, this kind of state indoctrination or this kind of weaponizing, but we see it more for like sub-state groups, sometimes religious groups, sometimes like these sovereign states, and so where this kind of indoctrination happens and weaponizing as well, and framing theories that have been out there, like giving them a new frame, like a current frame. So that's happening, and I also like this idea, like, okay, so we have maybe a big event like COVID, we might talk about that. So it's something we all have, we are unfamiliar with, we have to somehow deal with it. And as you said, like, it's one way, maybe like an emotional regulation to come to these conspiracy theories. And it raised a lot of about critical questions to many people, actually. So what was going on, and also like the measures that were taken. But I would still say there's like, we have to differentiate between these reactions. I mean, it's already, I guess, in the definition of conspiracy theories, right? It's like there are no coincidences, everything is connected. And so where like the critical thinking basically stops. And so I think we can make, we can distinguish here. And but it's something, knowing that, it's also something that can help us to work with these people on a individual and on a societal level.
Can you maybe tell us about like some recent case that struck you mostly?
Okay, yeah, I can try. I have two cases in mind. One is a client that came to us. It's like in the in the crossroads of right-wing extremism, extremism, and also like classical conspiracy theories, kind of has been active in during the COVID Querdenken protests here in Germany. And yeah, what struck me was a bit this, actually the beginning, like how it all started coming to us. It's a huge step. And it was, I think it was possible only because there was a conflict between the beliefs, the belief system that had built up, and actually the career pathways that were also very important to this person's identity. And there was a good setting for a counseling process. And yeah, we have made great progress in like reflecting the conspiracy theories, the psychological necessity of them, and finding alternatives and finding stability. So I'm quite happy with this process, and that I'm also happy that we have the possibility to go into a process that it's not only just 1 hour of counseling and then it's done. And I think, yeah, that's what we always have to consider. It's a process. It takes time. And the other one was actually, there was first a relative coming to us, father, and who was worried about the son being in this manosphere, in like incel culture, anti-feminism, hostile in what the person was saying. And so he was very worried about his son. So, and we started the process with the father, and then he actually asked his son if he's also willing to come to the counseling, and he was, because he had a reason. He wanted to stay in touch with his father, and that's also something that we observe a lot, that it's a chance, and it's about these relationships a lot. And so I first talked to him, to the son, and he and was very open, just listening to what he had to say, and trying to get away from the ideology that's behind it, or that's in it, and to yeah, what he's personally finding there, and why he's needing that, and what else, where else he could maybe find it, and talked about the relationship to his father. And then as a next step, we combined it, and we had a great conflict mediation, and leading to a very, very honest sentences, where they had the possibility to talk to each other without being in this kind of, yeah, oppositional mute, and this being opponents, talking about ideology and the ideas of word, and they still are not like in line regarding that, but they found a way to actually honestly talk about it and to listen without judging too much. I mean, it's also important to set boundaries, and they also found boundaries in this kind of mediation.
There is one thing I wanted to add to what Florian was saying. I think we have to emphasize in this conversation that the amount of power and energy that Florian puts into these counseling processes, talking to people that have been driven by conspiracy theories, and the fact that they actually came to seek for advice and seek for support, that is actually one of the most fascinating and really great things. And because in my career of studying conspiracy theories, not only Russian but in general, this is one of the hardest parts of the process, because you sometimes you have to speak to people that whose worldview is absolutely different to yours. And it's not like the argument online that is being kind of spinned by, I don't know, some stupid meme or some stupid social media post, right? Viral social media post. This is actually people with real problems that have realized that the rabbit holes where conspiracy theories took them, they actually bring in somewhere completely wrong, completely problematic. And having conversation, providing support to these people, this is something that should really be appreciated. And there's another thing that I'd like to mention in this context is that we should not, nevertheless, that people come and seek for support because conspiracy theories can really ruin their life. Not to mention sometimes conspiracy theories can kill innocent people, right? We shouldn't really forget about that, because what we currently see in Ukraine is it's a somewhat result of weaponization of conspiracy theories that really kill people every day. And one thing we need to remember when we talk about conspiracy theories in the context of emotions, that for various people, conspiracy theories might play completely different roles. So for some people, given their cognitive nature and behavior and their previous traumas and experiences, they can be damaging. But then for some people, again, let's not forget, conspiracy theories can be a useful way of perceiving a very complex world. And it is this fine line between a somewhat critical, somewhat skeptical analysis of the world that around us and this slippery road into the rabbit hole that we need to be mindful all the time.
I think I need to get back to this point I made before about the countercultural or critical view on conspiracy theories. And I think it's important to note that there is a difference between the context that Florian described, where people actually experience some kind of tension in their social life because of their engagement with conspiracy theories, where they may violate some expectations or norms in their immediate social surroundings and may actually lose people close to them or threaten social relationships in their, for example, immediate family. And so that is one perspective, and that is, I think, closer to the more psychological perspective, where you can ask, okay, what kind of, how does this conspiracy belief help you? Why are you, or what kind of purpose does it fulfill for you? And what negative outcomes might be associated with it in your job or in your social relationships? But then we can also take the more cultural, more macro level perspective and ask for, okay, are there conspiracy theories that may actually point to some underlying structural or political problems? To which degree can we even decide what is kind of a legitimate expression of political grievances, who we are to decide what counts as a conspiracy theory and what not? I mean, we can go into definitions and see how complex that gets quickly. But I think there are two developments in sociological research that are kind of interesting in this respect. The one is looking at conspiracy theory as a label, and that also serves as a label to exclude people from discourses. And I always remember one situation where I was in a department meeting at a university, and a professor was making a point that the university leadership was pursuing some policy to kind of take power away from the department. And then another professor just said, well, not everybody's a conspiracy theorist like that person, like the one that talked before. So it's a label of exclusion on the one hand. Immediately the first speaker got quiet and didn't raise the point anymore. So that is kind of the labeling aspect. And then of course, we also have this this countercultural argument, like conspiracy theories as a way to raise concerns where no other avenue to raise them is open. And we can also talk about the COVID example, for instance, where there was, of course, some expression of uneasiness with political measures, with the kind of invasion into the private sphere by the state that cannot just be dismissed as only like a psychological shortcoming or deviance of some kind in those individuals, but clearly has some kind of a political underpinning. And also, because we are talking about affects and emotions, also has political emotions underpinning it, not only personal anxiety, but also political anger about the way that that state officials dealt with the problem. So I think it's kind of the challenge is to kind of balance these levels and try to differentiate between those.
Yeah, thank you, Philip. I totally agree. I think these aspects don't contradict each other. I think they're all part of it, and as you said, on different levels. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like the labeling also shows how emotionally it can get, and also how it can get weaponized. We also see it on state level, how it's used, right? Like all the narrative of the others. These are the conspiracy theories. Yeah, that's another way to look at it. What is also related to it is that it's depending on the normality and also, so this can also be on every kind of level. It can be on a state level, just normal, and we see it in maybe partly in the US right now, and also in other countries. But it can also be in my peer group, and that's, I think it's both in a way the same what's behind it, and that's just the question: what's normal here, and what do we perceive as reality? And only the things that are going against this reality are the ones that are to be dismissed, are the problematic ones. And and also like what you said about it and the problematic issues, that it's also political. I would also agree. And the political emotions, it's interesting. It's I haven't heard this phrase. Maybe you can get into that later. So for me, like the emotions can be raised due to political issues or political decisions that I maybe don't agree with. That's the one thing. But it, like, I think in the combination of lack of autonomy, like suddenly I'm not allowed to go on the streets again anymore, not to meet with another person. I mean, that's huge. And of course, the lack of power is getting very, very visible and feelable in these situations. That can be, I guess, like a brutal situation. And again, I would still stand behind my point that there is a difference that you can basically define it from a kind of almost neutral standpoint to say, okay, it's or it raises the question, when does a conspiracy theory get problematic? And that's also, Ilya, what you basically said, like it can be a part of maybe a radicalization, or it can be really weaponized, it can lead to really harmful actions. And maybe to ask this question, when does it get problematic for concerning person, for the family, for society? And I guess that can be helpful. And what kind of harm does it do?
So how would you answer this question?
Well, I'd say it always depends in a way, but like for the individual, as I said, the emotions it raises can be very positive, and a positive identity. We haven't talked yet about the significance gain people that's in there. So very, very positive identity. And if you challenge that, of course, then it gets tense, and anger can arise from that. So it can be problematic for the individual when it gets isolated and when the effect gets negative. So that's clear. And then there's like this gray area, if it's already negative, if friends and family are pulling away or I am excluding them from my life. So maybe I will realize later on that it's negative, but maybe I can live to the end of my days and having a positive identity. And for families, I mean, it's a conflict if they have, as Philip said, or also like they have different norms and the friction is there, so it gets problematic. But interesting, for most people, like of the relatives, it gets problematic because of the morals and societal morals, and rather than personal feelings. And of course, violence. I mean, it's a simple answer, but when violence and discrimination is involved, it gets problematic. But then new questions arise: when does the private end and the public start? And with this perspective, it gets really, really complex. And we in the counseling center at Veritas, for us it's a bit easier because we work with the people who come to us, with the clients and with the questions and the needs that come to us. And at the same time, of course, we try to really get to our target groups and to invite the people.
Let's still try a little mock-up, okay? So imagine I come to you. into your consultation. And let's say I started watching Russia Today during the COVID pandemic because I felt like they were giving me better information than the European mass media. And now all these sources of information are blocked. So I'm really pissed off that I have to use VPN or I have to use some other ways to get to this information. And none of my friends really wants to understand me. I feel really isolated, but I still feel like I really have to tell the world the truth because what the media is telling us here, this is just so one-sided and we have to understand what's going on there. So if I would come to you in this situation, feeling very isolated, very angry, but also feeling like I know the truth about something that no one else does, how would you start the conversation with me?
Yeah, so I would probably firstly like see what the context is. Like, I probably wouldn't invite you to our counseling center for the first meeting, but meet at a public place. I think that's helpful for everybody. And okay, you're there, you're angry. I would say maybe this is like the step before most people come to us who are directly affected by conspiracy theories. And you have a high missionary pressure. I would take you seriously. I would let you talk, but I would probably not start arguing with you about the content. I would ask like, well, why do you think is that making you so angry, and how is it related to your personal life, and what do you actually need? I would try to hold the relationship and not to reproduce this experience they often make, that people are rejecting them very, very fastly. I would be there and I would ask myself, what are my boundaries here, and make them clear. And I would a bit, I guess, like in a way, mirror or say, well, like what I'm perceiving, what this is like, how this is making me feel, and asking if there's maybe some understanding, and trying to talk about this level rather, and what's helping me, and this is what's already before the conversation, is that I'm saying, okay, there's this belief system, and there's also like a person with the needs. We talked about this, and sometimes it gets very, very intertangled. But to have that in the back of my mind helps me maybe to stay in the conversation, but also to know, okay, if it's too much, I'll go out. And I think that's important because it allows me to really be in the conversation, and that's already a different reaction than they expect. They maybe expect that I'm challenging the views, and maybe they start, or this person starts to think about it on a different level, on the personal needs, or maybe this person just keeps on being angry, and then I might say, okay, yeah, I'm seeing you're angry, and so I'm asking, why are we still talking? What do you want from me in the end? What do you actually want? And then it's like that's a crossroad, right? Maybe the person won't stop, and then I think it's better to end the conversation, but in a good way, without, as I said, reproducing the experiences, or maybe something will open up and then we can continue with that. And I would also ask about the life circumstances, maybe to find resources. That's something we often do, to look, are there other people in the life that can be supportive? And as we pointed out before, like a job, something like that motivates the person to basically find a relief, that conspiracy theories can be a relief. But of course it turns when you're so focused on it, and your whole life is focused on that, and it raises this anger, and then it can be a relief to get away from that. And then I will try to find this kind of relief islands where people can go find some rest, and maybe that's a better space for reflection.
So you're talking about validation of feelings, creating a safe space for conversation, but also about creating distance to a topic that is so triggering. But you also mentioned that you wouldn't challenge this person's beliefs. And I want to ask Ilya, so if I came to you with the same set of emotions and questions, what would you tell me from your perspective as a researcher, what would your reaction be?
On the personal level, I come across these kinds of people all the time because I have to speak to many interlocutors in Russia and discuss with them or try to explore how certain propaganda narratives go down. If I had and when I had similar conversations with people driven by conspiracy theories, my kind of main objective, again, probably I need to say that I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychotherapist, etc. But probably the main objective is to define what makes these theories appealing to an individual. What sort of narrative, what sort of twists, what kind of stories serve as appealing, explanatory narratives to this particular person. Again, let's take, for example, the idea of anti-vax movement. And I've written an article about that with my colleagues when we looked at the Telegram channel in Russian language, but it was set up by the Ukrainian guy in late 2020. And at the peak, it had 120,000 subscribers. And that was called COVID Resistance. That channel had all kinds of content. And we actually had the chance to speak to the founder of this channel. And his explanation was, A, I did not believe the official information. B, the way how the virus was presented in the media, it was not a compelling version. So I tried to find an alternative explanation that would work for me. And C, there was quite a lot of general anti-elite attitudes there. So all those post-Soviet countries were united in this channel in their grief about the way how population is being treated. And in that sense, when we had this person in front of us, and when I had similar conversations with people who believed or who endorsed conspiracy theories about COVID-19, my argument was, let's try to kind of trust a little bit to the science, right? To the science of it, because we still have certain measures in place, certain checks and balances. But the overwhelming response was, there is nowhere there. There is nowhere to be found, these checks and balances, this trust, this reputation. It's gone. Why would we trust it? And in that sense, probably it's worth getting to the bottom of it and of this each individual. And certainly we don't have the resource for that. But when we try to really grasp why people do not believe the official line, at what point they broke, at what point they sort of changed the track, switched this track, if you wish, and became the believers in conspiracy theories.
Philip, do you have an answer to that? You're looking actually exactly into that in your research.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because I just, in this mock situation, I also thought about like how would I respond to, or how did I in the past respond to people who tell me about their conspiratorial beliefs. And of course, the last thing that would come to my mind would really be to make a factual argument or try to convince them of something. But I think rather also be interested in learning more about their personal life and get into a conversation about that, because it also would be easier for me to relate on this level. But maybe more to your question, or maybe that's an angle to your question, at least, there is a lot of research in the context of conspiracy and misinformation that looks at interventions. And a lot of this is still inoculation theory. How do we debunk conspiracy theories and so on? But I think from what everybody here has said so far, I think that doesn't seem to be really helpful, because it is not about factual knowledge. It's not about arriving at verifiable facts. And we could kind of turn the thing around a bit. And there are some arguments made that actually even scientific discovery, even scientific discourse that is supposed to be governed by these rules of rationality, is still also driven by affect, and is still also driven by us being in the rush of finding out something new, of having this feeling of everything falls into place if we read a theory that gives us a new perspective on a social phenomenon. So we are not so unfamiliar with that feeling. And then the argument would be, okay, in conspiracy theory, theorizing as a practice, maybe there are some guardrails missing. Maybe it's kind of a runaway discovery that only capitalizes on this fascination of finding the big explanation without this kind of more careful, toned down critical affects that make us afraid to get it wrong, that are like, oh, I shouldn't say something that I can't really back up with facts. And this part is then, I think, in some cases missing in people who really engage in this conspiracy theorizing. Although I might add to that again, it's a differentiation. So there are these people who are really entrenched, and I think you, Florian, you mentioned that before, like conspiracy belief become the one structuring aspect of their life and the one reference point for interpreting reality. But then there are also casual conspiracy believers, and also the argument that we all hold to some degree, or that we are all prone to interpreting social reality through agency, through machinations of groups that, and in some cases we are not wrong, and there are always these examples like big oil hiding climate change and these smaller conspiracy theories that prove to be of substance in the end. And then there's also a third group that is not casual conspiracy theorists, but I would describe as more enthusiastic and less problematic. There are these conspiracy conventions, and there is sociological research, ethnological research of these kind of conspiratorial movements where people meet and discuss different theories, and they kind of even define themselves as conspiracy theorists, although there are still these exclusions. Some people may be too extreme, some people may be too radical. But this is also an area where community happens within the conspiratorial group, and where people don't seem to encounter, or at least not all people encounter, this problem where they then come to you for counseling. But there are there is a great article on QAnon, how that this kind of collaborative online research where people gather clues about QAnon then also turns into something like a self-help group where people also provide support with regards to other aspects of their life. So all of these different groups work a bit differently, and not, I mean, that runs a bit away from your question, I guess, about how to address this. But I think in neither of those cases, it's really about what is factually true. It's more about questioning the mechanisms through which truth is socially constructed, and maybe presenting some alternative version of that, or gaining the agency to produce your own truth, or to question the authority on truth.
I think this point on community is very important. And I think, in a sense, why we are observing such a boom in conspiracy theories everywhere for the last 10 years, I think, in a sense, it's a consequence of how isolated we became as individuals, caught online 24 hours a day. And certainly we need to bear in mind that there was a generational shock for many, especially young people, that were affected by COVID-19 and staying indoors for months and months and months. That affected them a lot. So they, in a sense, they are part of it. So finding a community through this peculiar way of seeing the world and discussing the world is actually probably, it's a way of therapy for these people. But on the opposite side here, if we're talking about emotions and the internet, let me be really provocative here. It's like At what point, Florian, are you going to suggest to your clients to forget and delete all the social media from their phones and stop consuming the content that is designed particularly to bring the worst emotions in place?
Yeah, I'm going to answer to this question a little bit later because you two sparked such a great discussion. And I think that the point of community is really, really important from different standpoints, like from a psychological standpoint. And I'm preparing for today. I was a bit fascinated because I realized that the sphere of believing in conspiracy theories offers like a solution for one of the biggest conflicts: to gain personal significance and to belong to a group, belong to others. You can have both here, and that's also something that's really motivating and helping to maintaining this belief. And yeah, these communities, we sometimes observe them, and sometimes like we also have the contradicting imagery of like this lone wolf. And again, as you guys already said, like this sharing or establishing a certain social reality, which is becoming my only reality. You also talked about this general feeling of like anti-elite, and I think that's also also important. This being anti, being alternative, finding alternatives. That's also using this wording, and we observe that most people come with a certain conspirational belief, but they're also like, if they come across another theory, they also pick it up. And Philip, you talked about agency, and that's really important, I think, and we have seen it during the COVID time in the protests. This kind of agency and the regaining autonomy by going on the streets. I mean, it's a very democratic thing to do it, and still most of us would probably find it in a way problematic. But so this shows like how this is intertwined, and this is also like the political action they take. And I just talked to somebody who came to us for counseling in the context of a criminal proceeding. That's also something we offer. And he said like he was still very, very impressed what they reached. So for him, they made it possible that the whole COVID thing was ended by the protest. But at the same time, we observe regarding COVID, there are people... or can say it in two sentences following each other, that COVID never existed and it was created in a laboratory. So we speak about this level of paradoxy, but contradiction is still like very, very crucial, I think. In a counseling context, I would use it when autonomy is something very important for the person, and then I see, okay... But here it seems like you're indoctrinated. You're following somebody else's idea. Doesn't it contradict maybe like your wish for autonomy? So that's something you can also try. Yeah.
I wanted to respond to this point on community or expand on it a bit, because you asked me before about political emotions as a concept, and I think this is where it kind of comes in, or where my idea of individual emotions becoming somehow collectivized and tied to political agency through conspiracy theorizing really makes sense, because you have these kind of starting points. You may have some sense of anxiety that is either individually like caused from your personal life or from political circumstances like COVID, where you really have this big thing going on that you can't really wrap your head around. You may have personal experiences of powerlessness. You also refer to that as one of the drivers. So you have this kind of inefficacious anger, the anger that you cannot enact, that gets kind of sedimented and builds up some lasting ressentiment. And you may also have this kind of individual level, this little fascination with these dangerous conspiracies and these little feelings of enlightenment. But only through engagement with conspiracy theories, or not only through, but this is one way to make these all collective and to contain this anxiety in a fear that is not objectless, that is not somehow diffused, but that is directed at the conspiracy as the object of fear, so to say. And this is what makes it political. You can make a political claim. You can say we need to lock all of them up. And Same for anger. Anger becomes directed at also at conspirators, but also often at other groups. Like you often have this kind of double structure where you have the elites or the conspirators, but you also have some excluded group. I think you see this in the Great Replacement theory, where you have the globalists, or codes for like Jewish elites, that are orchestrating this kind of big migration. And then also the migrants themselves, while they are not the conspirators, they are also an excluded group. And I just wanted to raise this point about the complexity of this emotional process, because it shows how community is produced within the group, within the collective. But then this community is based, or is often based, I should say, on exclusions. And this is what makes it, I would say, politically so problematic, that this kind of internal community only works because there is some attribution to blame to some other group, and some other group is in the end dehumanized or portrayed as ultimate evil. And that is kind of one of the central features, I would say, of conspiracy theories. So I don't want to cheer for conspiracy theories as being this nice communal innocent activity also, but they have these real implications that have to do with the way they politicize emotions.
We've talked about different emotions. We haven't talked about shame. I think that's also an important emotion in there. I think it can also be like a process of like a mutual learning, like people going to these kind of protests, and then they talk to others, and then they hear their ideas, and they have a common ground. The protest being anti something, anti COVID measures, and so on, or mistrusting the government. That's a strong bond, and they're building up on this and picking up these stories. And also this classical image, somebody being on the internet and falling into this rabbit hole. And then it's like, I think Philip described it earlier, this feeling of things are falling into place. And then, wow, so this epistemic need actually that is fulfilled there.
I don't want to dismiss kind of the psychological arguments. I think you can measure this as a trait. I think the arguments about lack of control and anxiety on a personal level are all valid, but we can also sociologize this a bit and maybe ask ourselves, is there something that these conspiracy theories or engagement with them as kind of, we could say, effective practices, is there something that they achieve on a social level that is so effective that it just gets repeated and repeated again and again, and it doesn't really matter what the substance of the claim is? So if it comes to this question, why do people believe in so many conspiracy theories and keep on switching to new ones? I sometimes take this step back and think, okay, why do movies work? Why do people always watch basically the same movie, like Hollywood movies being also like patterned in a similar way as cultural products, right? And I would also say they achieve some kind of socio-emotional function. They tell us stories about how to feel about certain things that then also seep into our social relations and so on. Or I could also ask myself, like, why am I currently checking news apps on the Iran war every morning? This is also this kind of information gathering that becomes kind of a self-reinforcing practice. And whatever Trump does next will be my next focus. So, and this is also something, okay, what is the actual benefit for me personally? Am I even affected of this? But there seems to be this kind of, or there probably you could counsel me on this and try to find out what the personal reason behind this is, what this achieves for me. But there's also, apart from the individual level, there's the broader infrastructure. There are newspapers who write these stories. There are political interests involved and power relations. And all of this comes together in this kind of practice of information consumption, I could say. Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, I was in Barcelona and I went on a guided tour, and I learned an interesting fact that I was very fascinated with, and I couldn't quite put my mind around it, but at the first instance, it really, really impressed me. So we were talking about the Jewish life in Spain before the exile of the Jews, or rather, you know, before the moment that they were forcefully exiled by the Spanish monarchy in 1492. Our guide was talking about what happened to people who stayed and how they were trying to fit into the Christian Spain. And at some point, he very convincingly mentioned that Francisco Franco was a Jew. He seemed very knowledgeable of this fact. And everything else he was talking about during this tour was actually really impressive. And I really liked the tour. So I took it in without questioning it much. And when I came back to Berlin and I met with a few friends who are very knowledgeable about Spanish history and also about Judaic studies, I told them about that. And they told me, well, look, this is a conspiracy theory, exactly like saying like Hitler was a Jew. It's total nonsense. And it was really hard for me to swallow that because I already made up a whole story in my head about why this could be true, why this actually sounded convincing. And I'm Jewish. I instantly thought of the story of Walter Benjamin, you know, who killed himself on the border to Spain because he, as a Jew, was trying to flee from France to Spain. And our guide was telling us, well, you know, Franco was a Jew and he was definitely not a very good person, to put it mildly, but because of his Jewish origin, you know, he was sustaining this policy of letting Jews pass through Spain. And I was like, okay, yeah, that makes total sense. I never thought of checking it. I never thought that that could be anything that I should doubt. So what do we do? What should trigger our attention? What should put us on guard? Is there anything, is there any to-do list? Is there any procedure that we can implement when we face stories like that before we actually really become attached to them?
I think firstly, we need to be super vigilant about any information we receive these days, because this is something we've also haven't covered, sadly, but the effect that AI has on personal lives. And we know multiple instances when people replace real kind of conversations with real people with AI, right? Finding AI much more comfortable interlocutor. So in that sense, the joyous explanation is never trust the tourist guides, because, you know, they tell stories. Their job is to tell fabulous narratives which people will like and will endorse. So in that sense, that's quite an obvious thing. But then we have an incredible amount of instruments these days to run checks within seconds, even in minutes. I think what we are missing is kind of the training and sometimes the time, A, to check the facts, but also to train within ourselves. And I'm talking about everyone, right? Even the best scholars can make terrible mistakes in that regard, like being led by fake facts, let's put it that way. We need to be vigilant, everyone, and keep in mind that, yes, we can read about this, we can hear stories, some things that we consume online on a daily basis in different modes and different periods of our day, these kind of pieces of information should be trusted with a pinch of salt. So it really is the training, and it really is the training that needs to be kind of blanket, and 100% of the young generation must have this kind of training when it comes to fact-checking.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for this story. It's wow! I didn't know where this was leading, and it was really, it got me somehow. And it's I was thinking about the situation. It's really tough. I mean, you basically had trust, like this guy. There was not a context where you have to be alert usually, and you had no reason, simply no reason to question that guy. So that makes it hard. Also, like thinking about how often we are in situations like this, and most of the times we don't realize that something might be wrong in a way. So agreeing with you to be alert, to really check what we're hearing, what we're listening to, and at the same time it's tough. And you talked about the young people, the youth, TikTok and so on. It's really this kind of information consumption. It's I think it's a bit next level going there. But still, of course, we have to support like training for that and this kind of reflection. The thing is, and it like if we start reflect and go with what we are already questioning, then we don't really challenge our own worldview so much. And I think that's a second step we need to do, like really to question ourselves, to ask ourselves, okay, what is my what worldview is maybe behind that, what I'm hearing here, and what is my own. And then when you get suspicious and on either side, then really follow up on that and talk to others about it, give space to your ambivalences. I think that's important.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be completely relativistic or anything, but I'm currently engaged in a project where with a colleague where we interview young people, high school, like 13, 14 years old, and they show us actually their TikTok for you pages and talk about how they consume this content. And what we see there is that conspiracy theories, like these kind of closed theories and even factual narratives at all, don't really play that much of a role for them. They are very, I could even say, very fatalistic about social media. They kind of always say, well, I don't know if it's true, this could be all AI. They are very used to consuming AI content. They often say, well, yeah, also with this stuff that is sold to them, like fitness stuff or products, they are always very much on this side of, yeah, they could tell me anything. I always ask a friend about it. I ask somebody outside of social media about it. And they all had this kind of, well, not all had, but many of those already have this talks with teachers about dangers. They are aware of cyberbullying and all of these topics. And I sometimes think that we kind of circle back to our own, or there's a contradiction in our own argument, because before we argued that we talked about how factual checking is not everything, how this creates these contradictions. And now we are talking, okay, but how do we educate people to identify actual truth from falseness? And that's an interesting tension. And I don't want to dismiss the need for some established facts at all, but I sometimes think that there is also a moral panic around youth and social media usage, and we don't, well, we may not often look into what they are actually doing on the platform so much. And to go back to your story now, I mean, I agree with everything that was said, but I also, I mean, this is an example where it worked out, right? And it, somebody told you a different version of the story, and you even got an insight from it. You now have this. You can ask the question, why did he tell this story about Franco being a Jew? Like, what is politically and socially achieved with this? Is this some attempt to reconcile some historical guilt or problem? Like there are power structures involved here. It's not just a person that decided to tell you a lie in order to achieve some specific goal for themselves, but we can even see it as a, like, if we look at this kind of truth not as this very fixed category that we can pin down, but ask for the social conditions producing it, it's actually an anecdote that can just raise further questions and is of interest. But yeah, that's maybe not very satisfying.
But I think what I learned from this case is that the emotional appeal of new information actually is a strong prerequisite to check upon it, because conspiracy theories, they don't just offer explanations, but they also offer emotional orientations and a way to feel less lost in a complex world. And perhaps the whole challenge is not just to debunk the conspiracy theories, but actually to understand what kind of emotional needs they're responding to and how else these needs can be satisfied. And this is what we have been talking about here today. And thank you very much for joining me here at the Collaborative Research Center Effective Societies at Freie Universität Berlin, Florian Jäger.
Thanks a lot.
Ilya Yablokov.
Thank you.
And Philipp Wunderlich.
Yeah, thank you for the discussion.
If you'd like to learn more about the research behind this conversation, check out the work of the Collaborative Research Center Affective Societies at the Freie Universität Berlin. We explore how emotions and affects shape our social worlds, from everyday relationships to global politics. You will find more information, including links to current projects, publications, and upcoming events on our website, www.sfb-affective-societies.de. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more mixed feelings.